Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, welcome back, everybody. This is episode 230. We've got a great show this week. We're going to be talking about the Morgan Affair, which should be pretty awesome. Before we get started, just like to mention that this show, of course, is brought to you by Brothers Blend Coffee, coming straight out of Milford, Massachusetts, from Montgomery Lodge, right to you. The very finest of coffee to the brethren wheresoever dispersed, their friends, families, and colleagues, available in the Tyler's Cup, Harmony Roast, and Adoniram's Brew, which is the strongest of them. They are not taking orders from outside the United States through PayPal. If you are outside the United States and you would like to get some of this coffee, you want to email them at sales@brothersblendcoffee.com. Junior Wardens and Masonic Caterers ask about discounts on large orders. Again, sales@brothersblendcoffee.com, or if you'd like, go ahead and visit www.brothersblendcoffee.com. And again, a very special thanks to Brothers Blend for sponsoring this program for many episodes. So we really appreciate the sponsorship. Brothers out there who are listening to this show, if you appreciate this show, go on and help out Montgomery Lodge in Milford, Massachusetts with their fundraiser of Brothers Blend Coffee. It's a fundraiser to support the charities, causes, activities, and maintenance of the lodge. It's a great charity. Again, we all have bills to pay. They have some too, and they're doing something really cool to raise funds. So why not? What have you got to lose? They come in 12-ounce bags. They're $12.79 per bag, all taken care of right there through PayPal. And the coffee is roasted locally as well, right there in Hopkinton, Mass. By Red Barn Coffee Roasters. So please check them out, www.brothersblendcoffee.com. So in the news this week, I need to mention that we are going to be having a guest host next week. That guest host is Brother Adam Thayer, who is a worshipful master, and he's been in Masonry a long time, belongs to the Nebraska Grand Lodge Education Committee. Very knowledgeable brother, exceptional at scholarship. He is going to host the show next week, and he'll be hosting the show from time to time when I can't, or when I have vacations or presentation schedules, or my schedule is just way too busy. He has done us a great, great favor in accepting the challenge of coming up with content and the like for this program. So next week will be the first episode ever with Brother Adam Thayer as your host. So I hope you enjoyed that episode. I know you will. I know I will. Also, just a quick shout out, Brother Shimeon is back in town. Really stoked about that. Midnight Freemason contributor. He wrote a new article just last week, so please check that out. He's got a couple more coming in the future. Presentation schedule for myself has been a little bit crazy. We had to change a couple things around. I was going to be at Masonic Week this upcoming week. I am not going to be at Masonic Week now. Looking at the schedule of events, there's just not a whole lot that I can do there, and it doesn't really warrant spending the cash to go out there to go to one or two meetings and shop and sleep. Although I could use the sleep. So I will not be attending Masonic Week. The next place I will be, though, March 15th, I'll be at Oshkosh, Wisconsin, Waverly Lodge number 51. I'll be talking about the Word. And then again, just a few days later, I'll be making that same presentation on March 19th at the Pennsylvania Academy of Masonic Knowledge. And I'll be speaking with the Masonic Roundtable. So the five hosts of the show, myself included. So we've got John Ruark, Juan Sepulveda, Nick Johnson, and Jason Richards, and myself. We are all going to have an individual speaking part, an individual keynote, if you will, and we will then have some sort of a joint presentation, and we'll have a lot of fun that day. I believe it is TMR all day long at the Pennsylvania Academy of Masonic Knowledge, so we're really looking forward to that, and all of us are going to be there for the first time ever in the same room. May 31st, I'll be in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at Damascus Lodge number 290, and there is a possibility of a Honesdale Lodge in Pennsylvania appearance later 2016. More details to come on that as they emerge. I'm not entirely sure of that either yet, but it is a strong possibility. I've got great friends out there, Brother Clint and Brother Brian Evichin and Brother Jamie. All the brothers out there are just tremendous, so I hope I can make it out there again this year. Congrats to Brother Juan Sepulveda for 3 years of podcasting. So time flies, Brother Juan. I couldn't be happier and more honored to call you a personal friend and more especially your brother. Really proud of everything you've accomplished with your podcast and the places you have taken it. You've been an inspiration to not only Masons that I know, but also to podcasters. So thank you so much. You really are some heart and soul that lives within this niche subcategory of podcasting that is Freemasonry. So again, Brother Juan, thank you so much. We hit some roadblocks with Masonic Radio Theater. So if you caught the announcement on the Facebook page, it's true. We are on a hiatus with Masonic Radio Theater. Masonic Radio Theater has always been a side project. It was never guaranteed. It will be back. We just don't know when. Brother Bill Hosler, one of our head writers, has had some interesting computer technical difficulties. Myself, I have just been bogged down tremendously between Midnight Freemasons, this podcast, my duties as a district education officer and secretary to a lodge, as well as balancing life and work. It has taken a severe backseat, and I find myself with less and less time to work on it. I know we got a big cliffhanger with that Lodge of Gold hanging out there, but I promise you those parts are all done and recorded. We just need to find the time to put them together. So perhaps this summer we will have a revitalization of Masonic Radio Theater and we'll put it out there. I am taking a more active role in something that I really believe in. It is not Masonic in nature, but you should know that some of my time will be there. I am taking on a large role for Iron Mike magazine, becoming a print editor. I'm going to be releasing a full-blown magazine that primarily focuses on the American way. It focuses on great stuff, camping, being a dad, fishing, firearms, whiskey, cocktail recipes, dinner recipes, featured articles from anywhere from people like myself all the way to distinguished veterans. There is a tremendous veteran tie into the magazine. That is, the magazine scope is Iron Mike, which is, of course, after the Iron Mike statues portraying veterans, those bronze statues you might see in parks and the like. It is a great magazine, and if you have a chance, head on over to ironmikemagazine.com or ironmikemag.com, and you can check out some of the articles we've written there. Some really good stuff. The Masonic Roundtable, I missed the last episode. I was at an official visit for a local lodge. I couldn't make it. I do apologize. Hopefully, I will be on the show next week, and we should have a great show because I think we have a special guest that I'm really excited about, and I can't really let the cat out of the bag until they release the Facebook post for the week. So I think you guys will all like it. Got a great guest coming on who is super knowledgeable, super funny guy, pop culture extraordinaire, kind of a guru. And whenever we don't know if we're doing something right, this guy's a perfect sounding board, in fact. So I really appreciate this guy coming on. Again, regarding last week, we had great feedback about the Star Wars and Masonry. Couldn't be happier on the comments. Brother Jared Chapman had some amazing things to say. Speaking of Jared Chapman, you can check out his blog as well, which is out there. His blog is called Fresh from the Quarry. It's really good. It's chock full of information, and he's a great writer. So please do check that out if you get a shot. And with that, we're going to go right into this week's paper. And after that, the illustrious Stephen L. Harrison will come on for the Masonic Minute. We'll come back with the famous Freemason, and we'll wrap the show. So without any further delays, here we go with the Morgan Affair. The Morgan Affair. Perhaps the most romantic story of Freemasonry, the fuel which the alleged abduction and murder of William Morgan supplied to the anti-Masonic hysteria of 100 years ago, and the gradual emergence of the ancient craft from the cloud which threatened to extinguish it, is a tale which all Freemasons may ponder to their enlightenment. William Morgan, a brick mason, lived in Batavia, New York from 1824 to 1826. Accounts of him differ widely, as they do of any notorious person. Few are so wicked as to be without friends. Few are so good they have not their detractors. From the estimates of both enemies and friends, the years have brought an evaluation of Morgan which shows him as a shiftless rolling stone. Uneducated but shrewd, careless of financial obligations, often arrested for debt, idle and improvident, frequently the beneficiary of Masonic charity. That he was really a Mason is doubtful. No record of his raising or lodge membership exists, but it is certain he received the Royal Arch in Chapter Ram No. 33 of Leroy, New York. It is supposed that he was an eavesdropper, and lied his way into a lodge in Rochester by imposing on a friend and employer who was led to vouch for him in Wells Lodge No. 282 at Batavia. Judge Ebenezer Mix of Batavia, a Mason of unquestioned reputation, wrote of this alleged Masonic membership, quote, "There must have been a most reprehensible laxity among the Masons both of Rochester and Leroy, for there was no evidence deduced then or afterwards that he ever received any Masonic degree, save the Royal Arch on May 31st, 1825 at Leroy." End quote. At any rate, he visited lodges, was willing to assist, made Masonic speeches, took part in degrees. When companions of Batavia asked for his Royal Arch chapter, he was among those who signed the petition, but suspicion of his regularity began to grow, and his name was omitted as a member when the charter was granted. Just how much this incident inspired the enmity he developed for the fraternity is only a guess. Doubtless, it had much to do with it. Enemy he became, and it became known that he had applied for a copyright on a book which was to quote-unquote expose Masonic ritual secrets and procedures. In spite of the deep resentment which this proposed exposé created, Morgan entered into a contract on March 13, 1826, with three men from the publication of this work. These were David C. Miller, an entered apprentice of 20 years standing, stopped from advancement for cause, who thus held a grudge against the fraternity, John Davids, Morgan's landlord, and Russell Dyer, of whom little is known. These three entered into a penal bond of $500,000 to pay Morgan 1/4 the profits of the book. Morgan boasted in bars and on the street of his progress in the writing of the book. The more he bragged, the higher the feeling against him ran, and the greater the determination engendered that the exposé should never appear. Brethren were deeply angered, fearful that, were the secrets of Freemasonry exposed, the order would die out. Feelings ran high. Matters came to a head in September of 1826. Morgan was arrested for the theft of a shirt and tie. Of this he was acquitted, but immediately rearrested for failure to pay a debt of $2.68, and he was jailed. After one day behind bars, someone paid the debt. When he was released, he left in a coach with several men, apparently not of his own free will. He was taken to Fort Niagara and there confined in an unused room. Then Morgan disappeared. What happened to William Morgan? Enemies of the craft said Freemasons had kidnapped and murdered him to prevent the publication of his exposé. Freemasons, of course, indignantly denied the charge. As time went on and Morgan was not found, members of the craft disavowed any approval of such an act if it had been committed. Governor Clinton, past Grand Master, issued proclamation after proclamation, the last one offering $2,000 reward if the living Morgan might be returned to his family. If murdered, that the perpetrators might be brought to punishment. It was not difficult to discover that Masons were concerned in Morgan's 125-mile journey to Fort Niagara. Three members of the craft, Chesbro, Lawson, and Sawyer, pled guilty to conspiracy to seize and secrete Morgan, and together with Eli Bruce, Sheriff, and one John Whitney, all served terms in prison for the offense. But murder could not be proved, for nobody was found. In October of 1827, a body was washed ashore 40 miles below Fort Niagara. Morgan's widow identified the body, although it was dressed in other clothes than her husband had worn alive, was bearded, although Morgan was clean-shaven, had a full head of hair, although Morgan was bald. Thurlow Weed, Rochester editor, was accused of having the corpse shaved and of adding long white hairs to ears and nostrils to simulate the appearance of Morgan. The first inquest decided that this was indeed the body of William Morgan. Three inquests were held in all. The third decided on the unimpeachable evidence of Mrs. Sarah Monroe, who minutely described the body, its marks, and its clothes it wore, that the corpse was not William Morgan, but Timothy Monroe of Clark, Canada, her husband. Commonplace and unexciting truths seldom catches up with scandalous, electrifying, remarkable falsehoods. William Morgan had disappeared. Freemasons had been convicted of abducting him. A body had been found and identified as Morgan. That better evidence and a less excited jury had later reversed this identification was anticlimactic. The stories of Morgan's murder persisted. Thurlow Weed, whom history shows as an unscrupulous opportunist, no matter what the exact truth of his activities with the body may have been, added fuel to the flames. Weed died in 1882. On his deathbed, he stated that in 1860, 22 years before, John Whitney, who had been convicted in the conspiracy charge, confessed to him the full details of the murder of Morgan. According to this alleged confession, Whitney and four others carried the abducted Morgan in a boat to the center of the river, bound him with chains, and dumped him overboard. Weed stated, and here his memory failed him, that Whitney had promised to dictate and sign this confession, but died before he could do so. But Whitney died in 1869, 9 years after. Whitney did indeed tell a story, not to Thurlow Weed, who was his accuser in the conspiracy case and whom he hated, but to Robert Morris. This story is both the most probable and the best attested of any that we have as to the true fate of William Morgan. Whitney told Morris that he had consulted with Governor Clinton at Albany relative to what could be done to prevent Morgan from executing his plans to print the expose. Clinton sternly forbade any illegal moves, but suggested the purchase of a Morgan manuscript for enough money to enable Morgan to move beyond the reach of the influence and probable enmity of his associates in the publishing enterprise. From some source, Masons, Governor Clinton, Whitney was assured of any amount needed, up to $1,000, which was a great sum in those days. In Batavia, Whitney summoned Morgan to a conference, in which the bribe was temptingly held forth. On the one hand, the enmity of all, persecution, continual danger, it is not improbable that threats were mingled with the bribe. On the other hand, money, safety, freedom from a plan to publish which held much danger. If Morgan would take $500, go to Canada, quote-unquote disappear, his family would be provided for and later sent to him. Morgan agreed. He was to be arrested and kidnapped to make it easy to get away from Miller and his associates. Whitney feared that without some such spectacular escape, Morgan might at the last moment decline to go through with the plan, fearing reprisals from his friends in the publishing venture. Whitney told Morris that two Canadian Masons received Morgan from the hands of his kidnappers at Fort Niagara, traveled with him a day and a night to a place near Hamilton, Ontario, where they paid him the $500, receiving his receipt and signed agreement never to return without permission of Captain William King, Sheriff Bruce, or Whitney. Later, there were two other confessions of complicity in the murder of Morgan, neither consistent with the facts. Doubtless they were of the same hysterical origin which leads so many notoriety seekers to confess crimes which by no possibility they could have committed. Did William Morgan choose the easier way, disappear with $500 from a dangerous situation, eliminating him from responsibilities, a wife and family suddenly burdensome, and, in a new freedom, ship on a vessel from Montreal and out into the world, there to come to an unknown end? Or was he basely murdered by Masons who thought the crime less than the evil results to follow on the publication of Morgan's book? No one knows. No incontestable evidence can be deduced, or was ever figured out, to definitively prove either solution. All that is undoubted is that William Morgan was apparently kidnapped and did disappear. It is difficult, 100 years after, to understand the extent and power of the widespread excitement and passions this incident created. For the fame and infamy of the Morgan affair spread over an immense territory. It was the beginning of an anti-Masonic sentiment which grew and spread like wildfire. Meetings were held, the order was denounced by press and pulpit. An anti-Masonic paper was started with Thurlow Weed as editor, soon joined by the Anti-Masonic Review in New York City. The many groups in Pennsylvania already opposed to any oath-bound society, Quakers, Lutherans, Mennonites, Dunkards, Moravians, Schwenfelders, German Reformed Church, they were all aroused to a high pitch of feeling against the alleged quote-unquote murderers and kidnappers, the Freemasons. The anti-Masonic excitement spread fast and far. Gould, in his History of Freemasonry, thus epitomizes the spirit of the time. Quote, "This country has seen fierce and bitter political contests, but no other has approached the bitterness of this campaign against the Masons. No society, civil, military, or religious, escaped its influence. No relation of family or friends was a barrier to it. The hatred of Masonry was carried everywhere, and there was no retreat so sacred that it did not enter. Not only were teachers and pastors driven from their stations, but the children of Masons were excluded from the schools and members from their churches. The sacrament was refused to Masons by formal vote of the church for no other offense than their Masonic conviction. Families were divided. Brother was arrayed against brother, father against son, and even wives against their husbands. Desperate efforts were made to take away chartered rights from Masonic corporations and to pass laws that would prevent Masons from holding their meetings and performing their ceremonies. End quote. Reverend Brother John C. Palmer, Grand Chaplain of the Grand Lodge of the District of Columbia, says in his Little Classic of the Craft, Morgan and the Anti-Masonry, Volume 7 of the Little Masonic Library, published by the Masonic Services Association in 1925, quote, "The pressure was so strong that withdrawals by individuals and bodies were numerous. In 1827, 227 lodges were represented in the Grand Lodge of New York. In 1835, the number had dwindled to 41. Every lodge in the state of Vermont surrendered its charter or became dormant, and the Grand Lodge, for several years, ceased to hold its sessions. As in Vermont, so also in Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and in lesser degrees in several other states. The Masonic Temple was cleft in twain, its brotherhood scattered, its trestle board without work, its working tools shattered. Thus Masonry endured the penalty of the mistaken zeal of those fearful brethren who thought that the revealing of the ritual to profane eyes would destroy the order, and who hoped to save it by removing the traitor within the camp." End quote. Space here is not sufficient to retell the interesting, often exciting, and always varied story of the political campaigns which were predicated on and took much of their ammunition from the anti-Masonic excitement which followed the Morgan affair. It is not to be supposed that the abduction and alleged never-proved murder of Morgan was the sole cause of this outburst, any more than was the assassination in 1914 the sole cause of the World War. Both were triggers which set off guns which, in turn, caused other explosions. Suffice it here that a wave of hysteria was seized upon by able politicians, fanned by demagogues, increased by the righteous indignation of good men and true who saw not beneath the surface, helped onward by press and pulpit with the best of intentions but little understanding, until the whole East flamed with passion and Freemasons were spit upon in the streets. Lodges threw away their charters and Freemasonry bowed its head to a storm as unjust and undeserved as all religious persecutions have always been. Like any other hysteria this past, passions wore themselves away, a few sturdy and brave men stood staunchly by, a few grand lodges with high courage and the strength of the right never ceased to proclaim their allegations, their allegiance to the principles of the order. Little by little, Freemasonry raised its head. One by one, lodges took heart. Brother by brother, craftsmen returned to their altars. After a period of following almost 20 years or more, or less, complete eclipse, the sun of Masonry shone again, and the world was treated to a spectacle that has been a heartening lesson to millions, and will be to counted millions yet, to be born anew in the sacred altar of Freemasonry. The strange sight of an order may had thought dead, suffering from uncounted thousands of stabs to the heart, coming again to life to grow and thrive and attract to it then, as it had in the historic past, men of the highest character. It is for this that the craft of today can offer thanks to the great architect for the Morgan affair. Dreadful as it was to the men who lived through it, terrible in its consequences to the brethren who suffered, it demonstrated again, and it may be hoped and believed once and for all, that the underlying faith of Freemasonry, its ancient landmarks, its foundation upon deity and the great light, together are stronger than any evil, more lasting than any ill will, and more enduring than any human passions, forever, forever, and forever. So mote it be. All right, well, I hope you enjoyed that paper. I find the Morgan affair absolutely fascinating. And if you do like the Morgan affair, check out episode number 1 of the Masonic Radio Theater. We're not taking the episodes down. They'll still be live and able to listen to, but we dealt with something that happens very similar to this storyline in the first episode called The Craftsman, episode 1 of Masonic Radio Theater. Check it out. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. As for me, I'm going to be quiet for a minute. We're going to let illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison take it away with the Masonic Minute.
Sometime back in the 1950s, my lodge, Liberty No. 31 in Missouri, had a fire. It's a familiar story. The fire destroyed nearly everything, including precious membership records. Members, as usually happens, rebuilt the building, but the membership records were lost forever. Or so we thought. Then, One day back in 2004, our secretary was rooting through our junk room and came upon an old box. When he opened it, he discovered membership logs from the mid-19th century. What a find! Rummaging through the records proved fascinating, and before our next meeting, for what it's worth, I was master at the time, the secretary and I sat there going through some of them. We were mainly looking to confirm the names of some of our previous masters and also trying to see if any of our members had been prominent citizens of the era. Suddenly, the secretary slid a book across the table to me and pointed at an entry. "What do you make of that?" he asked. The name on the line read, "C. Younger, entered apprentice." Underneath that was another entry, "Littleton Younger, rejected." The entries were from the records of 1852. We were both thinking the same thing. C. Younger? Would that be Cole Younger? The notorious bandit turned Confederate Civil War guerrilla Cole Younger? In my opinion, Cole Younger wasn't exactly Freemason material, but I had to find out. I began checking the next morning. It took about 15 seconds to figure out C. Younger was not Cole. Thomas Coleman Cole Younger was born in 1844 and would have been a kid at the time. But who was C. Younger, and in fact, who was Littleton Younger, and why was he rejected? We found no records to indicate our C. Younger advanced beyond the first degree. He was not Cole's father, whose name was Henry. His paternal grandfather, however, was named Charles. Cole also had an uncle named Charles Younger. Nothing in my research led to any concrete conclusions. Cole's grandfather, Charles Lee Cole Younger, died in 1854. He wouldn't have been a Mason for long, but perhaps that might explain why he only received the first degree. Since Cole's Uncle Charles was not as old, it may be more likely he was Liberty's entered apprentice. If he advanced, those records might be among the items still lost. Once Cole's escapades as a thief, murderer, and member of Quantrell's Raiders began, Uncle Charles moved out of the area. Born in Virginia, Littleton Younger, also one of Cole's uncles, moved to Kentucky, where he met and married his wife, Eliza. From there, the couple moved to Liberty, where they had 5 children. After their children were born, they moved to an area northeast of Eugene, Oregon. There is no record as to why his petition for membership was denied. Once described as a sportsman, perhaps he shot something other than the white-tailed deer indigenous to the area. Whatever the case, once established in Oregon, he did, in fact, join the fraternity. His gravestone shows he was born in 1816, died in 1893, and it bears that familiar symbol, the square and compasses. It's almost certain Cole Younger was never a Freemason. At the age of 18, he had already committed his first murder and had a $1,000 bounty on his head. He is known to have killed 17 men and was shot so many times he once said of himself, "I guess you could strike lead in me in almost any place you drilled." He died peacefully in 1916 at the age of 72. In all, he was one of the most notorious men in the country, along with another famous Clay County, Missouri resident, Jesse James, whom he hated. But that's altogether another story. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, many thanks to illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison for his amazing work. If you enjoy those segments, you can go back and you can watch them. That's right, watch them. He actually creates short videos for these, and we host them on our YouTube channel. So check those out if you get a chance. Let's pay the bills really quick. You heard me at the top of the show mention our biggest sponsor, Brothers Blend Coffee. Please check them out, www.brothersblendcoffee.com. In addition to that, check out onitlabs.com. Now, rather than just go to their website, go to wcypodcast.com, click on support the show, and click on one of the links we have to go to Onit. By going through the link, you guarantee that this show will get a little bit of a donation from Onit because of the cookies and the way they record the transaction. So please do that. In addition to that, my thanks to you is they have given me the coupon code WCY. You can use at checkout in order to get 10% off of your order. Right now, if you want to get some Alpha Brain Instant, the month of February, they're running a special on that for anybody who is an affiliate with Onit Labs. They will give us a little bump in the monetary assistance. I use Alpha Brain all the time. I just started using Alpha Brain Instant. It's really good. You just dissolve it in 8 ounces of water. It uses stevia as a sweetener, so it's all natural, no caffeine, and it's decent. It kind of tastes like a cinnamon tea. We do take direct PayPal donations, so if you do a PayPal donation, you can head on over to, again, support the show and click PayPal donation. You pick the amount, whether it's 50 cents or $5, whatever you feel like giving. You will always get a thank you card from me in the mail, and if you donate over $10, of course I'm going to send you a pin or something like that. So again, I really do appreciate all the donations. We do have pins, tie bars, money clips, and cufflinks for sale. I think I only have one tie bar left, so if you are the one to get it, congratulations. And remember, this is what makes you guys the producers of the program. So if you see somebody with a Masonic pin on and it's a Whence Came You pin, thank them because they're bringing you this show. This week's famous Freemason is Samuel Woodson Price, born 1828. Passed away 1918. He was an artist and soldier born August 5th, 1828 at Sugar Grove near Nicholasville, Kentucky. He showed an unusual talent for drawing and painting at a very early age. He studied portrait painting under artist Oliver Fraser in Lexington, Kentucky. In 1847, he painted a portrait of William King Solomon, a local character, which set him off on his long career of portrait painting. He entered the Union Army at the outbreak of the Civil War with the rank of major and was soon made colonel of the 21st Kentucky Volunteers. He participated in the battles of Stone River, Resaca, and Kennesaw Mountain, where he was seriously wounded above the heart. Brevetted Brigadier General of Vernon E. Pritchard Volunteers on March 13, 1865. Served as military commandant of Lexington, Kentucky in 1865, and from 1869 to 72 was postmaster of the city. He then moved to Louisville, Kentucky. He painted more than 200 well-known Kentuckians and prominent people of his day, and is considered one of Kentucky's greatest portrait painters. Wrote the Old Masters of the Bluegrass, 1902, story of noted artists, painters, sculptors of Kentucky. He was a member of Good Samaritan Lodge No. 174 of Lexington from 1850 to 1852, and records show he was a member at Lexington Lodge No. 1, Lexington, Kentucky, from 1867 to 1874. He died on January 22, 1918. That's it for this week. Please remember to find us on Facebook, follow on Twitter, check us out on Google Plus at the email address wcypodcast@gmail.com, or you can email me at admin@wcypodcast@gmail.com. You can also email me at those addresses. Anytime you have a question, I'm more than happy to answer. Sometimes it takes me a week, sometimes 2 weeks to respond to an email if it's a longer one that you have lots of questions for. And that's just simply because I want to make sure that I respond to each and every one of your comments and questions. And so I have to spend time to sit down and do that. So I do appreciate the patience. Again, thank you for all the donations. Thank you for producing this show. I am sorry, again, I won't get to see you at Masonic Week. But if you're at Masonic Week, please say hi to John Ruark, Jason Richards, and Greg Knott from the Midnight Freemasons. He'll be there, and I'm sure he will love to talk about Freemasonry with you. I'm really bummed out because I've never got to really hang out with Greg Knott. I was really looking forward to it. So, Brother Greg, in the future, we'll have to get together. So, again, thanks again. We'll talk to you all in 2 weeks because next week, special guest host Adam Thayer will be on the program, and it's going to be fantastic. So, until then, stay on the level. Whence came you? I'm Robert Johnson.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.